Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Duving, your host. Thanks so much for joining us every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. We stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We are also rebroadcast on Sundays at A-Zen.fm, and we archive these programs at richarddugan.com. The radio shows page, lots of opportunities for you to hear from our guests. We also are linked to our guests' websites, and we encourage you to check them out. I don't like to reinvent the wheel, so I encourage you to go to their websites where they've created the wheel in their likeness and fashion, if you will, so that they can provide you with the information that will give you those choices and knowledge thereof so that you can start making your dreams come true. It's great to come to you every Saturday, and every Saturday we have a special guest on the program, and it is my pleasure to welcome to our program today Bruce Lipton. He is the author of Biology of Belief and Spontaneous Evolution, and I want to welcome you to our program. It's great to have you with us.
I am so happy to be here, Richard. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
I know that you are very closely associated with a lot of folks, including probably one of my favorite people. I consider him a brother. I've been interviewing him for over 15 years, Greg Braden.
He's my brother as well.
Yes, and
we're in the same family. Yeah,
I would have to say, I think the phrase goes, brothers of a different mother or something along those lines.
Yes, exactly. But we'll have a family reunion sometime.
I look forward to that. I really do. I've had the pleasure of actually meeting him in person, and it was short, but it was very nice, and it's always nice. I've obviously seen his face as I've seen your face, but neither of you have seen mine until that opportunity. So it's really kind of neat to have those opportunities when you're in conferences or seminars or workshops. And speaking of which, you have one that is coming up the end of October as we speak here on the 13th of October. That is, I believe it's I Can Do It.
I Can Do It Hay House conference with a lot of their wonderful authors, and they're letting me present there as well, so I look forward to that.
Well, we'll talk more about that later on in the program, but it's interesting that that particular title is similar to the title of a book from an author I interviewed early on in this radio program back in 2007. I Can, I Will was the title of the book. And here you and a bunch of other folks are going to be participating in the I Can Do It seminar or conference or workshop. And I find it interesting that they've used that title because I know that a lot of us struggle with I think I can, I think I can, instead of I can do it.
This is an absolute truth, and the struggle is so interesting because most of us perceive the struggle is between ourselves and the universe around us. Like, I have this great intention to do it, and it's not happening, and I'm trying, and so since it's not working, then, you know, it's against my fate, or I didn't get a good hand of cards, or whatever you want to claim. And then we look at the world as being really a tough place to be in when we're now beginning to recognize that most of the problems we face are from our own subconscious minds. So as we keep looking outside where the problem is, it really started inside.
You know, it's also interesting, too, because I've had a chance to look at both of these books that you have presently out, but specifically Spontaneous Evolution. And I thought, that seems almost to be not a contradiction, but mutually exclusive terms in the sense that evolution kind of is spontaneous in a manner of speaking.
Well, it's very interesting because all of us have been programmed, and I even taught the program to students in medical school, et cetera, the concept of, oh, evolution being this long, you know, going on for millions and billions of years, very slow change that nobody can see, but over long periods of time. And it turns out that perception, which is a Darwinian view of a very long imperceptible change process, turns out not to be actually accurate, because now we're recognizing that there have been times on this planet that are referred to as mass extinctions, where life is bustling, everything is just like it is right now. Life is really going along great, and then some cataclysmic event, boom, the whole thing turns upside down. I sort of refer to it like the Etch-a-Sketch evolution, where you know, on the Etch-a-Sketch thing, you make this big image, and all of a sudden you shake it, and the image is gone. You got to start all over again, and five times in the history of this planet. So there are abrupt changes. So it's like it goes along, it seems like on an equilibrium, and then all of a sudden what they refer to as a punctuation changes the flow and then shakes up the whole thing, wipes out life down to little bits and pieces, and then they start all over again, the whole evolution process. So this has been our history five times. It's Stephen Gould and Niles Eldridge are two evolutionary scientists that came up with this understanding in their work. It's called punctuated equilibrium, which is completely different than a slow, progressive, imperceptible change over time. It says, no, radical upheaval, boom, something new happens. So we're on an edge of that right now. In fact, science has already documented, as this is a fact that nobody really wants to talk about, which as a scientist, it galls me sometimes. It's like, oh, we're, you know, the whole political spectrum is gay marriage, abortion rights. It's like, no, wait, here's a fact that we are currently in facing what is called the sixth mass extinction of life. Right now, biologists have recognized that human behavior has undermined this web of nature to such a degree, the way we destroyed habitats and environments, et cetera, that we're losing species of organisms on a rate much faster than the previous five mass extinctions, and that all of the crises that we're looking at around the world today, anything from peak fuel to climate change to economic and all that, all of those, when you look at them as individual crises, it's like, well, here's a tree, and there's a tree, and there's a tree. But if you pull back, you start to recognize, man, we're looking at a forest. It's all the same. It's all part of the same thing. And this is what I think we need to wake people up to, is that all the crises we're facing are part of one crisis, and that is we are not sustainable and the way we're living. So you have two choices. We're facing this right now. Continue doing what we're doing, and extinction is actually imminent. I mean, when science recognizes as a fact that within 30 years the fish will be out of the ocean, that's like a science fiction movie. Planet Earth, no fish in the ocean. It's like we're on the edge of that. And so we're facing either we continue to do the same thing and watch it all just wind down, or, and this is the point, it's a choice point, we collectively decide to move in a different direction. And that will be almost like the equivalent of spontaneous evolution. We're moving one way, and then the people all of a sudden face all these crises and say, that's it, move the other way. And that switch from one way to the other way will not be dragged out over hundreds of years. It's a year or two or three at the most of a transition where we will move into something different.
I've seen some history programs actually dealing specifically with what you were just talking about in terms of this is our sixth go-around and so forth. And I think the thing that strikes me so – it's like, are you kidding me? It's kind of what goes through my mind is that, as you just stated, we as a species literally end up starting from square one every single time. But – even more importantly than that, and I hope you can address this, is if we have annihilated ourselves as a species completely and entirely five times, where then did we come from? If we wiped ourselves out, then who reseeded us here?
Yeah, well, that's the interesting part, is that each reseeding starts off at a more fundamental level. Think of it like this web of life as a spider web, and a big wind comes through and blows most of the strings out, and there's some pieces left. Those are the pieces from which the new life will spring forth. And it's interesting because I said conventional belief is, evolution occurs over millions of years, and when we go back and look at those events called punctuated equilibrium events, we find that all new species arise within a few thousand years. And so what it really says is perhaps our understanding about how heredity and evolution unfold is incorrect. And matter of fact, good question, is that right? And the answer is yeah. We have misperceived life. And this misperception affects us as individuals and affects us as the superorganism, humanity, which is actually what's trying to evolve. A lot of people think, the evolution, evolution is always perceived as a change in the biology or the structure. This organism transforms into this organism. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, well, yes and no to some degree. That's not the evolution we're facing. The evolution we're facing is an evolution of an organization. And this is misperceived in when we study evolution. That looks like a continuum.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out evolution is not a continuum. It works in a pattern that's very interesting. It is very simple. The repetitive pattern is this: you start with a distinct organism. The organism proliferates, so you get a large population of those organisms. They start to form colonies and then communities, and at some point, the community of these organisms becomes so well developed they actually represent a new organism. Well, now you have a new organism. Guess what? Play the same thing again. A new organism starts to proliferate, create larger communities and colonies, and then differentiates into another new organism. So if I just repeated the sequence very simply, is the first organisms on this planet were bacteria, the little microorganism. They started out, they created a big dispersed population for a billion or 2 billion years. It was just isolated bacteria all over the place. Right. And then they started to come together and form communities and put a membrane around themselves. They're called biofilms. So they're integrated communities of bacteria working together in harmony. They specialize, and it turns into a new organism called the amoeba. So when we look at the amoeba, you say, oh, that's its own cell. They go, no. That's the evolution of a community of bacteria underneath a membrane. So you go from bacteria, community, new organism, amoeba. Amoeba starts into reproducing, and then the next billion years there were bacteria and single-celled amoebas, and then the amoeba started to organize into communities. And to let us know where that might lead to is when we recognize ourselves as a human being, we see ourselves as individual organisms. I go, well, see, that's a misperception.
Mm-hmm.
A human, by definition, is 50 trillion amoebas who have come together to create a community. Mm-hmm. We're made, the living parts of us are the cells, and the cells are the amoebas. So you say, well, a human is what? I say, an integrated community of amoebas. So the human is like the new organism, then what? They proliferate, form into communities, and then integrate into a whole new organism, humanity. The evolution that we're facing is when we decide to recognize we're not individual people that just accidentally populated the Earth. We're like cells. Each human mm-hmm. is like a cell that is being integrated into the superorganism, the new level called humanity. So the evolution is not a biological change in the individual human. It is an organizational change where we recognize that every human on this planet is part of the same superorganism, humanity. And
right.
And then you might say, well, Bruce, how's this evolution coming along right now? And I would say, very interestingly, that new organism of humanity is suffering from autoimmune disease. An autoimmune disease is when the cells of a body fight each other and bring down the health of the system. Well, where are we? An organism trying to evolve as humanity with cells fighting each other. So humanity is having this case of autoimmune disease, and yet, if you stand back globally and look what's happening, there's a breaking down of the political structures mm-hmm. that have separated us from each other. The Arab Spring is a great example. There's a falling apart of the economy, which in some sense has also separated us. It's all going to move into a new whole. And basically what science is saying is that if we recognize our unity as all people being part of the same organism and learn to live in harmony with each other, then the destruction that we're bringing to planet Earth will stop. And as we do that, this new organism will collectively replenish the garden, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very interesting because you say, well, you know, looking out there, this thing is shaking right now, and I'm going, well, everything is exactly the way it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
Because the idea of individual humans as not being connected to other individual humans on the planet, it's an idea that has to fall. And what's interesting is there's a whole movement already, but it's not in the news or anything like that, and it basically deals with what we call the millennial generation. The millennial generation are those people 40 and under. And what makes it very interesting is they are already exemplifying the superorganism for this reason. They are the internet-connected community. They're global. That people on one side of the world communicate with other people on the other side of the world and recognize, hey, we're all the same, looking for the same thing. The millennials are not the warring parties that want to fight each other. Millennials are actually disconnected from the structure. If you think about it, Many millennials have a wonderful education and find they can't get a job. They owe so much money, can't get a start in this world. Most of the millennials are working on these menial jobs after their education, and they're going like, "Whoa, with me, I can't get started in this civilization here." And the joke is this. They play the most important part of the evolution we're talking about for a simple reason. They're disconnected from the structure. So all of a sudden, if I said to you, you know, Richard, we're facing this evolution, and the structure seems to be shaking, which it is, and a lot of people who are invested in the structure are going, oh my God, this thing is shaking, and I go, look, half the population's not even connected. Go out and talk to a millennial and say, hey, the stock market's going to crash, and they're going to go, so? They don't own a stock in the first place.
Right.
So why is that relevant? You get half the population not attached to the structure, and you already have a mobile force that is generating its own structure. Mm. And so as baby boomers recede, millennials will organize it, and then you talk to millennials. They're the ones that are, as I said, globally interconnected, don't see each other as enemies, and are really a harmonious network, even though it looks kind of crazy right now. Within that group, they offer us the new future.
Interesting. You know, you raise a couple of things. Number one, I've watched a lot of history programs dealing with these kinds of things, the hypotheticals, the theoreticals, and so forth. And I often marvel at the comment that is made, especially about our history. And they get to a certain point, and this particular event happens, and they say, and this changed the course of history. And I'm going, wait a minute. Are you telling me that you knew the course of history was going to go in this particular direction, but because of this event, it went in a different direction? How did you know that? How did you know that it was going to, I mean, that's one of the things. But one of the other issues that you've raised, and I've been talking with people about this for the last, I'm going to say last year or two, because it's what came into my mind. You talk about the cells. We have, I don't know how many trillion cells of each in the human body. And I ask this question, especially in terms of the way that things are unfolding around the world right now on a human level. Under what system, I'll say ism, do the cells, the trillions of cells of the human body function? Now, I always tell them, the first system you have to throw out is democracy. Because if the human body's trillions of cells functioned under democracy, the body would cease to exist because everybody would want to do their own thing, every cell. But I couldn't use a particular ism because of the negative connotations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we're moving into another ism.
Right. But it seemed like it fit, and that was the construct of socialism. And someone said, oh, you can't use that. And yet the military functions under that very system. You cannot have individuals going off and doing their own thing if you're going to battle, because there's no chance for you to win. But I thought, okay, well, I need to come up with a non-negatively charged word. The only one I could come up with was interdependentism, but that's really long and convoluted and so forth. But the point is, you've made such a succinct point, is that it isn't so much about, per se, what system does it function under, what governmental body, if you will, or a set of rules, as much as, again, it is we are redefining, or we are coming into a new, as you say, organizational process.
Yeah.
And I like that concept as far as the millennialists. I don't actually feel left out as far as being a baby boomer who is going to eventually kind of go by the wayside, because I am understanding these concepts. I haven't in my entire lifetime, Bruce, I haven't been able to grasp the concept of wanting to rule over and control one or more other human beings other than myself. I just, that is, I can't wrap my brain around that.
I agree with you, Richard. If we look at the old models and try to say build the world out of the old models, look, the old models didn't work. That's why we keep trying all these different models. So it hasn't worked. And what's really interesting to me as a biologist is to recognize this. Look, when we talk about the repeating patterns, of individuals coming together in community and then integrating into these new structures. We are in that process right now. And what's most interesting is this, and this is like, we'll take a little sidebar, but come back, and then it becomes relevant. And it goes like, when you want to put structure into space mathematically, if I want to build something, I have to use a math called geometry. Geometry is the math of putting structure into space. The geometry that we all learned in school is called Euclidean geometry. That's the one with the graph paper and cubes and triangles and all that kind of stuff like that. It's really important geometry. We build our world. Human world is predicated on Euclidean geometry. The machines we build, the buildings we create, all these. But nature isn't built on that geometry. It's a totally different geometry. In other words, if I said use Euclidean geometry to draw, let's say, a tree, when we were 5 years old, we did. We made a tree, like a cylinder for the trunk and a ball for the top. Well, that's Euclidean, but it's certainly not nature. Nature has a unique geometry called fractal geometry, which is amazing new math. Mm-hmm. And the relevance about it is this, with fractal geometry, I can throw some numbers into a computer and generate a tree or a snail or, you know, clouds and a mountain. I can create nature by throwing numbers into the equation. And this is really one of the verifications that that the geometry of nature is fractal. And then you go, well, so what? And I go, well, here's what, so what? Fractal geometry uses the same simple equation, and it's repeated over and over again, and you do it by this. You have an equation, you solve the equation, you get an answer, you take the answer, feed it back into the equation, solve it again, get another answer, feed it back into the equation, solve it. It's a repetitious of the same simple equation. That nature is built out of a repetition of the same simple equation over and over again. Well, the relevance about all that is built into this math, and this is what's so exciting. Built into fractal geometry is an ancient mystical assessment that is as above, so below. That becomes an integral structure of fractal geometry, meaning this. If you're in a fractal geometric structure and you can see a pattern and organization at one level of size, let's say, then you will find that same pattern or organization repeated at higher or lower levels of size. Simple point. A human and a cell are fractal images of each other in this regard. You show me a function in a human body, and I'll show you where it is in the single cell.
Mm-hmm. Whatever
we do as a human, we can only do because cells are doing it. What's the point? The point is every single cell, by definition, is a miniature human. It has all the same systems, digestive, respiratory, excretory, nervous, even immune system. Has all the same systems, has all the same drives. Yeah, every drive of a cell is a drive of a human. As a matter of fact, every drive of a human is to support 50 trillion cells. So what I'm saying is, if you understand how a cell works, you understand how a human works. I go, okay, now as above, so below. And why this becomes relevant is now this. I understand, and we talked about, a human body is made out of about 50 trillion cells.
Okay.
That's an estimate. 50 trillion cells. Every cell is a miniature human. Guess what? Every cell has a job in the body. Every cell has a salary. Every cell gets protection, health care. Every cell, you know, the true vision of no cell left behind is what happens when you look inside the body. Every cell is working. Now, why is that relevant? And the answer is this. When you're a happy, healthy human being, what that really reflects is you have 50 trillion healthy, happy citizens in your body cooperating in a business venture. Cells have jobs, I said, you know, like a liver cell and a skin cell. They don't do the same thing. They don't even look the same.
And
every cell gets paid. And they don't get paid the same either. A skin cell does not make as much money as a nerve cell. And there's actual currency. It's called ATP. It's like a coin. Well, why you say is all this wrong? I say, look, here's a civilization of 50 trillion citizens that have learned to work in harmony with each other, and there's a communication between the government, the nervous system, and the citizens, and we call those emotions and symptoms. That's the feedback from the voting cells in the body telling you what they think is going on. And why is this relevant? When we start to listen to our body and the symptoms and pay attention to it, then we learn to keep the harmony and the health. And then I say, yeah, but we can't live with 7 billion people on this planet, and under your skin you got 50 trillion citizens who have created an economy and a social structure, and it's not communism, and it's not total democracy. And the name, I don't know. I use the name in the book, Holism. Because basically what it says is this: there is no entity on this planet, be it an amoeba or a human, that's not part of the whole structure. Mm-hmm. There's no structure that lives separate from all the other structures. There's nothing like that in the whole world. And that becomes important because every human is part of nature. And our failure to even recognize that continuity is what led us to unconsciously destroy the environment, the garden, which gave rise to us.
Yeah.
If we keep destroying the garden, we can't exist because we only were existing because of the whole garden. So it's really saying, let's go back, and you want to make a plan. Let's say, here's the biggest issue facing our world, the most immediate one. I mean, there's the crises we've listed, all different kinds. There's an economic crisis here. There's a reality that the money actually has no value to it, but nobody wants to stop long enough to ask that. We just keep moving. It's sort of like an avalanche going downhill. We're in debt like crazy. Everybody's in debt like crazy, but we're just ignoring that and keep going. And yet the reality is, hey, this economy doesn't work. It separates us. Like in the U.S., we're talking about 1%, 99%.
Yeah.
Why? But economy. And I go, well, what about in the body? And now here, I say, look, the fractal image of the body's organization is a template by fractal to understand how 7 billion people can live in harmony. So just a simple point about the economy, which is like, if we would do this, it would change the world overnight. It goes like this. Wealth is when you make more than you basically need to survive. So if you cut, you basically are just surviving on what you earn. You don't really have wealth, but you're surviving. If you make more and then you are making excess profit above the amount you need to survive, that's called wealth, okay? So here's the point. There's no wealth in the 50 trillion cell community of the body until every cell gets the basics,
mm-hmm.
until every cell gets protection, health care, food, and they're assured that every cell can survive. At that moment, once every cell has the basics, extra energy made by the body is then allocated to individual cells. They can accumulate like a bank account. They, in their biology, in their cell, they accumulate ATP molecules, which is like cash, And why is that relevant? Well, number one, all cells don't make the same amount of money. Like I said, skin cell doesn't make the amount that a nerve cell makes. So it's not communism, everybody makes the same thing. That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, what's the point? Everybody's got the basics, so nobody is missing anything. Then here comes the next interesting part. So the first level is everybody gets, the economy is first support everybody's life, so everybody's assured they're going to live. Second level of economy, excess profit coming in can be taken in by individual cells and held like an account to put energy aside for later. And then here comes the third part that's interesting. But there's only a physical amount of space in a cell that you can store the ATP, which means after you earn so much ATP, you can't hold any more ATP. So guess what? It goes into a community bank. And around my waist, I have a really good-sized community bank of stored energy. And what's interesting is the community bank isn't for any particular individual cell in the community. It's for the community. So if I break my leg and I have to repair the leg, my liver cells will go, hey, what are you using my money for to fix the leg? Is basically, no, this is a community bank.
Yeah.
And if we understood that, so the first level of economy in our world would say, first, make sure everybody can go to sleep tonight, be safe, and have some food tomorrow. And then from that point, once we're all safe, then we can start organizing a productive economy and start accumulating. And then once you have so much, you can't be like Bill Gates and have $60 billion. Well, like, 5 billion people have a dollar and you have $60 billion.
Yeah.
That doesn't work in the cells in the body at all.
Yeah.
So now, basically, it doesn't mean you can't make money.
No.
You can earn money.
Sure. I'm sure that there is there are going to be those who are going to vehemently disagree with you only because they don't want what is being referred to as a redistribution of the wealth. I mean, that's in essence, that's the terminology I think that would be used. And I take a look at that and I'm going, well, wait a minute. Under the current capitalist free enterprise system, we are redistributing the currency on a constant basis, only we're calling it marketing. If you are a consumer producer and there's a business out there that has a widget, they're going to do everything in their power to advertise to you, to market to you, to get you to buy that widget, to let go of those coins that you've earned. To me, that is the same thing. It's a redistribution, but we're making it okay because we're putting it under the guise of capitalism or free enterprise. And I'm not saying that's right or wrong. That's just the way it is.
Yeah, but you see, now the idea is this. Why are we harvesting all that money and hiding it in our bank accounts and burying it under the ground? And why are we doing that knowing that I'm accumulating all this mass, and those people over there, they don't even have two sticks to rub together to make a fire, and I've got these billions of dollars, and I can justify that. How can I justify that? And the answer is because we believe, and our culture is predicated on beliefs from science, of a Darwinian theory of evolution, which, the tagline is evolution is a struggle for survival with a competition for fitness. Mm-hmm. And basically, what does the Darwinian theory say, which we created as part of our culture? We bought the science that that's real and then built a world to match that belief. And I said, yeah, you're allowed, according to Darwin theory, it's the survival of the fittest. And I said, well, what makes you the fittest? And the answer is, you're the last one standing. You're the fittest. And I said, oh, does it take intelligence? Does it take compassion? No, it could take an AK-47. You could be the winner with an AK-47.
Yeah.
Biology, in a Darwinian theory, says whatever it means it takes to get to the end, you're justified. So if I have $1 billion and there are all these people starving to death out there, I justify it by science. I call it science. I say Darwinian theory says I according to theory, I'm proving my fitness. I have all those billions, so therefore I am successful in it. And those starving people, they're not successful. Well, here's the problem. That would be a cool world if Darwin's theory was right, but it turns out Darwin's theory is not right. It's the biggest problem in the whole world. It's not that evolution didn't occur, but it didn't occur as a result of competition. And this is what we're beginning. It's like the new edge of science is seeing this, but it hasn't come into the culture. The new age of science is not emphasizing competition as a drive force of evolution. In fact, it's just the opposite.
Yeah.
The new age of science recognizes that cooperation is the drive force of evolution. The concept of a garden is, by definition, a concept of cooperation. A garden is a war zone. A garden is all the organisms in the garden are working in harmony with each other. So we lost the garden, and we justify losing it under a Darwinian theory that says, you're allowed to beat the other one because the theory says if you're the last one, you win, and it didn't say how you got to be the last one. So we're all concerned with the end and disregard the means to that end. The theory is wrong.
Yeah.
Evolution did occur, but it occurred that every organism that came into nature, that evolved into nature, didn't get there randomly like Darwinian theory suggests, like random mutations. Every organism in the environment was introduced into the environment to bring harmony and balance to the environment. If one organism gets out of balance, nature introduces another organism to return to balance again.
Yeah.
And so all of a sudden you say, well, what's our job on this planet? And the answer is, my God, we're at one of the higher levels of the control of balance, so high that without knowledge that our job was to create balance, the power that we unknowingly wield has led to the destruction of nature. It's like,
yeah,
it's the same power that could create, harmony, and without knowledge of that, the power is used right now to destroy it.
Yeah. I want to, before we take our first break here, I want to let our listeners know that you're going to be a part of the I Can Do It Pasadena 2012 conference, and that is coming to the Pasadena Convention Center October 26th through the 28th, and you can go to icandoit.net to get more information, to register, to look at all the keynote speakers, including Bruce Lipton and many of the other folks involved
with
the Hay House. Greg Braden's going to be there, and there is a possibility. We'll see what transpires. I'm not going to be speaking, but I might be there, maybe get a chance to meet you in person.
I would love that.
But and before we break here, I want, again, to remind our listeners, this is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we're talking with Bruce Lipton. He's the author of Biology of Belief and Spontaneous Evolution. And when we get back from our break, Bruce, I want to I want to dive into a little bit more of this whole aspect of the biology, the genetic predisposition that we have, not just as a species, but then as the various and sundry races across the planet, of the various and diverse beliefs that we hold and we find it very difficult to let go of. And I'd like to talk a little bit about that when we come back and discuss further if we can do that.
I love that,
Richard. All right, great. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, and we want you to stay right where you are. This is a program that's bringing you new paradigms for a new world.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. We're talking with Bruce Lipton, author of Biology of Belief and Spontaneous Evolution. And Bruce, the fascinating conversation. And as I mentioned before we went to break, talk more about this issue of biology. We, you know, because we've mentioned our third quick break, he wrote a book called Spontaneous Healing of Belief. And that led me to the question that, okay, so are you telling me that some beliefs we want to heal from and some we don't? And he, you know, we went off that direction. But when I think about this concept of the DNA, that informational code that is within each one of us, I start to wonder if it starts to dive into those questions of and of predestination, free will, all of those kinds of things. And yet, just in what you explained, and I'm going to say the last 15 or 20 minutes of the last segment of our program, leads me to believe that, quite honestly, maybe there really isn't a whole lot of choice going on here, that when we tap into the awareness of who and what we are and where we fit in the universal picture, it isn't a question anymore about choice versus predestination. We don't care. It is irrelevant. It's almost like the totally irrelevant terms, because we're, as we like to say in the sports world, we're in the zone and nothing else matters. We're not even thinking. We're just flowing. Is that a fair assessment?
Well, yes, and then, but we still have to recognize that there's choice involved here, and it really involves that we have to let people know that their understanding about how biology works has been flawed. And I used to teach in a medical school the conventional understanding about how genes control life, and when we go to that belief system, then what does it mean when I say your genes can, you know, control your characters and your traits? And basically what it means, underline, this is what it means. As far as we know, we didn't pick the genes that we came with, and if we don't like our traits, then what we really, we can't do anything about it. Can't change the genes. So I said, well, what does that mean to us when you believe in this genetic control? And the answer is simply this. It means that we're victims. We're victims of our heredity. We inherited these genes, and I got cancer running in the family, and damn if I have to face that in my life because I got the genes. And all of a sudden, when you buy yourself as a victim, what does it mean? It means that you find yourself powerless. I am not in control of my life. My genes are. And this becomes problematic when you understand that the new biology says that whole belief is totally false, that we control our genes, and the genes don't control us. So what's the relevance of this? The relevance is simple. We must leave behind the concept of victim. Own the consequence that we control our genetics, our behavior, our life experiences. And in the process, we have to acquire something that we don't have as victims, and that's called responsibility.
Oh, my.
Well, I hate to say that word. Now half the people just hung up right away on this phone call, I'll tell you right now. And the reason is because it's a new science called epigenetics. And this is research that I started 45 years ago. I was cloning stem cells. And in a couple of minutes, I can explain this revolution. I hope I can. As simple as this.
Sure.
A stem cell is the equivalent of an embryonic cell. Before you're born, I'd look at this cell and say, oh, this is an embryonic cell. It could become anything in your body. The moment you're born, that cell is still there. Now, I can't call it an embryonic cell. You're born, so we change the name to stem cell. Okay, so stem cell, embryonic cell, same thing. I put one stem cell in the petri dish by itself, just one cell. It divides every 10 to 12 hours. After a week, I've got 50,000 cells in the petri dish, but what's unique, they all came from the same parent. They're all genetically identical. So I have 50,000 genetically identical cells, and here's the experiment. You don't even have to be a rocket scientist to get this one. It's straightforward. I take those 50,000 cells, split them up into three different petri dishes, and I change the environment ever so slightly. And when I say the environment, cells are like fish. They have to live in an aquarium of fluid. I provide them with all the things they need for their life in that fluid, all the chemistry. And if I change some of the chemistry in each of the three dishes, so I have three dishes of genetically identical cells, but they're in a different environment. In one environment, the cells form muscle. The second environment, the second petri dish, the cells form bone. And the third petri dish with a different environment, the cells form fat cells. And then you're left with a very important yet profound question: what controls the fate of the cells? And the answer is not the genes. They all were genetically identical. The only thing that was different was the culture medium, the environment in which they live. And that all of a sudden controlled the fate. That's why one dish their muscle and the other dish their bone. It had nothing to do with their genes. And then I say, well, okay, you say, well, Bruce, that's a really nice experiment in a plastic culture dish. What about me? I'm a human being. I go, here's the joke. As we mentioned before, as a human being, we're actually comprised of 50 trillion cells, the cells being the living entities and the human being, by definition, community of 50 trillion cells. I say, here's the joke. We are skin-covered petri dishes. Underneath your skin, you've got 50 trillion cells living in culture medium called blood. And then I go, okay, wait. When I change the composition of the culture medium, I change the fate of cells. I go, absolutely, in a plastic dish. I go, for the cell, it doesn't make a difference if it's in a plastic dish or a skin dish. It's still going to respond to the culture medium. I go, oh. Then all of a sudden the last piece comes in. I say, yeah, but the blood is the culture medium in my skin-covered petri dish. I go, yeah. And I say that your brain releases chemistry to control the composition of the blood. And then I say, but what chemistry should the brain release? And then I go, whatever your mind is perceiving. So very simply, I just say, if you open your eyes and you see someone you love, your brain releases into the blood chemicals like oxytocin, dopamine, vasopressin, growth hormone. These chemicals, when you add them to a petri dish, the cells in the petri dish grow exuberantly well. And that's why when you open your eyes and you're in love, you feel healthy because all this this chemistry is supporting your cells. But I said, same person opens their eyes and they see something that scares them. I go, oh. Now the brain releases stress hormones and inflammatory agents into the blood. And I say if I added those chemicals to my plastic petri dish of cells, the cells stop growing. I go, this is exactly what happens in your skin-covered petri dish when you're under stress. You release these stress hormones, and they shut down the growth and maintenance of the body as they conserve energy for fight or flight. So why is this relevant? The answer is, well, you can study a bunch of cells in a petri dish. You can study a bunch of cells in a skin-covered petri dish. And the point about it is this. The genes control nothing. The genes respond to the information from the environment. The mind is between the environment and the cells. And as the mind changes its perception, it changes the chemistry, which changes the genes. And why is that important? Your genes don't turn on and off by themselves. That whole belief that people say, am I gene turned on, my gene turned off, that is a false, outright false statement for a simple reason. Genes don't turn on and off. Genes are blueprints. If you go to an architect's office and she's working on a blueprint, you say, is your blueprint on or is your blueprint off? The architect, of course, will laugh at you like, wait, you're crazy? It's a blueprint. I go, exactly. And why is that relevant? Because we have given power of our lives over to the blueprints as a belief system and then bought into my heredity is my fate, when it turns out you can change your fate as fast as you change your mind. And the genes switch on and off. I mean, I love a great study by an internist, Dean Ornish. He's published a lot of interesting papers. Working with prostate cancer patients, what did he do? He said, look, rather than give you chemotherapy, I'm just going to change your lifestyle, give you a better diet, give you a way to handle stress, give you a meditation technique. And what happened? In 90 days, 500 genes changed their functions, especially the ones that were attributing to the prostate cancer, started to shut down. And what did it basically say was the genes didn't control this. When they changed their perception and response to life, they changed their biology. And this is the new science called epigenetics. And epi means above.
Mm-hmm.
When I say genetic control, that means control by genes. When I say epigenetic control, the new science, that says control above the genes. Mm-hmm. All of a sudden it says, it's us, we are the ones, and how we respond to the world that selects and modifies the genes that are in our body. And we can change each of our gene blueprints and create up to thousands of variations from each blueprint just on the way we respond to life. And why is this? Bottom line conclusion, I'm not a victim of my genes. I control my genes. I control my destiny with my belief. Except if I have a belief that I'm a victim, then I'm a victim because that's what I believe.
Right, right. Well, and it certainly answers it. I think it goes to answer that age-old question that's always asked, are we a product of our environment or are we a product of our genetics? And
yeah, and up to recently, it was like, oh, 90% genetics, 10% environment. With epigenetics, it's the complete reverse. 10% yeah. genetics, 90% of the way we respond to the environment. Why is that? We are so much more powerful than we actually believe we are, and yet our belief is what ultimately controls our biology. I mean, most people out there are familiar with something called the placebo effect.
Yes.
So what's that? It's like, oh, I believe this is the pill that's going to heal me. Everybody told me, the new science, blah, blah, blah. I take the pill, I get well, find out it's a sugar pill. And it's like, well, what healed you? Well, it wasn't the sugar pill. It was your belief in the pill. And then I go, and this is the most important thing that the audience really has to understand is, well, we always talk about placebo effect. Everybody knows the word and some meaning of it to some degree. And I go, yeah, but not that many people know about what is called the nocebo effect. The nocebo effect is the consequence of a negative belief. And it turns out, guess what? A positive belief or a negative belief are equally powerful in their influence on the body, but they work in opposite directions.
Yeah,
a placebo belief can heal me.
Mm-hmm.
A negative nocebo belief can actually kill me. And the results are what? It wasn't the genes, it was what we believe.
Yeah. And of course, now there's I've been hearing about studies that are being actually being done exclusively on the placebo effect and how real it is. It's as if if I needed this particular medication for this particular pain or condition and they give me a sugar pill but they don't tell me that it's a sugar pill, I'm going to believe that it's the medication that's going to take care of this condition. And guess what? It's taking care of the condition.
Absolutely. You know, most people, a surprising fact that most people are not aware of, one of the biggest selling drugs on the market today are Prozac-like drugs.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because from absolute scientific research from the drug companies, it reveals that Prozac is really not much different than a sugar pill in its effectiveness. And yet there are people that take Prozac and swear by it.
Yeah.
That this is the drug that healed me. And it's like, well, when you go in the laboratory and do the test, guess what? It's a placebo effect.
Because then you have to ask yourself the question, if the pharmaceutical companies absolutely tap into this whole placebo effect thing, they can just generate a bunch of sugar pills, charge hundreds of thousands of dollars for these prescriptions, and then again, there they are going off on this whole, we're going to accumulate this wealth that we need to have over here for God knows what reason. I wanted to ask you, going off into a little different direction, same basic aspect, in terms of biology, where does our soul, our spirit, or maybe going broader, the higher power that we are all inculcated with, regardless of the parts of the world that we are born in and raised into, where does that come into the equation? When you're talking about belief, and you've explained it exceedingly well as far as this whole biological aspect, but what about the spiritual, the more etheric, if you will, more esoteric?
Well, you know, Richard, I have a, you know, this would be outright blunt and honest about it. I never believed in spirituality, and that's why I was teaching in a medical school, genes, biochemistry, you're a machine, you're here, you're dead, dust, back, and all that. When I started to understand the nature of epigenetics, which is how is the environmental emotional signal influencing the genes inside the cell. And I started to recognize that, in contrast to what the textbooks say the brain of the cell is the nucleus of the cell because that's where the DNA is, and DNA makes all the decisions. Well, the fact that we talked about DNA makes no decisions automatically reveals that the nucleus cell is not even the brain of the cell. The nucleus is the gonad of the cell. It's reproduction. Mm-hmm. I need to reproduce the parts. That's what the brain of the cell is, the skin or the membrane. And when I started to understand the nature of it, it blew my mind for this one particular reason, because let's recognize a simple fact. There are no two humans that we know that are identical to each other for a simple reason. If I take my cells out of my body and put into yours, Richard, or anybody else that's listening, put my cells into their body, their immune system will say not self and reject and eliminate those foreign cells. And vice versa, you put your cells in anybody's body and their immune system will reject it as not self. So the first thing we have to recognize is this: cells have identity. There's Bruce's cells, there's Richard's cells. Mm-hmm. I say, yeah, but where is the identity? And it turns out, on the surface of the cell, there are these little protein antennas, just like little miniature television antennas. And there's a group of them that confer different identity. If I take these receptors off, and some of them are studied by medicine called self-receptors, which, interesting, means receivers of self. If you take some of these self-receptors off, the cells become generic. They no longer have identity. You can transplant them into anybody. They won't be rejected. If I take my cell, take my self-receptors off, and put Richard's self-receptors on my cell, if I put that cell back in my body will say, not self. And if I take my cell with your receptors, Richard, and put it in your body, your immune system will say self. So I said, wait, I can transfer the ownership by transferring these antennas. I go, absolutely. And all of a sudden, what I started to recognize, and it really blew my mind, is while we were focusing on the physical antennas, like a physical combination lock for identity, mm-hmm. they're antennas. They receive a signal.
Hello.
And all of a sudden, I said, wait a minute. The cell is like a little miniature television set with these little antennas drawing in. My cells are drawing in the Bruce show mm-hmm. on these antennas. Richard, your cells are drawing in the Richard show. Why is this relevant? Well, think about it. We're watching a television. We have an antenna on the top. It's pulling in the station. We're watching the show. The picture tube breaks. You say, oh, my God, television's dead. And I go, absolutely. It's not working anymore. Can't see the show. It's done. And then the question is, but did the broadcast stop? And the answer is, well, you get another TV, plug it in, turn on, and tune it back to the same station. It's back on the air again. Mm. If the television dies, it doesn't kill the broadcast. And all of a sudden, when I recognize this back at this one minute in my life in 1985, where I said, oh, my God, I am not in the cell. I am playing through the cell via these antennas. And that my life experiences that I have in this physical body are sent back by my nervous system from these antennas back to the source. And all of a sudden, I'm like, oh, my God, I'm not in here. My identity is part of the field, whatever the energy is out mm-hmm. there, and that I have a physical body that's like a robotic device to some degree that it has this broadcast being sent to me that is my spiritual self, and that becomes integrated with my life experiences, and we have a mind and all that. And if it sounds complicated, think about it this way. We can't go to Mars, but we can send up that Curiosity, that new rover that went up there, right? Mm-hmm. And you look at that little thing that looks like a little, you know, vehicle with wheels and things like that, and you say, well, that's a machine. I go, it looks like a machine, but guess what it is? It's the equivalent of a human, meaning this. I can't go to Mars, but I sure as heck want to know what Mars is all about. So I have to send up a device that can move along the surface of Mars, see it through cameras, feel it through temperature sensors, chemistry tasters. They're tasting the soil, see what it's made out of. Basically, I say, well, it's the equivalent of a human with all these abilities to respond to the environment and send back the data to tell me what Mars is like. Well, here's the point. The Mars rover is being controlled by a guy at NASA. He sends a signal. It goes to the antenna. The antenna picks up the signal, and through that signal, the guy at NASA drives a vehicle all around the surface of Mars. Mm. When the cameras record something, when the chemical sensors record something, it's sent back via the antenna to the guy at NASA. And all of a sudden I go, well, if the vehicle batteries die? If the Curiosity vehicle breaks and it's up on Mars, does that mean the guy at NASA died? No, no, he's still there. Send up another vehicle. It'll be different. But, and why is this relevant? If you really want to get to the connection, we are Earthlanders. We are vehicles moving around on the Earth that are controlled by a broadcast called Spirit. The relevance about this, and this I had to ask myself, so this is the joke part, which I always go back to, is I laughed so much when I thought about it. I didn't believe in Spirit. And then about 1 minute after I understood the mechanism and saw the self-receptors and the antennas receiving the broadcast and everything, I asked myself, at that moment, was the most profound question. Why have a spirit and a body? If I'm a spirit now, I just recognize I'm a spirit, then I have to look and say, but then why have a body? I'm already a spirit. And I asked this question of myself, and darn if my cells didn't come up with an answer. I could feel it. The answer came welling up out of my body. And the answer was this funny, simple answer. I asked, why have a spirit and a body? And my cells came back with this. If you're just a spirit, what does chocolate taste like? And all of a sudden I realized, if you're just a spirit, what does a sunset look like? If you're just a spirit, what does being in love feel like? I realized, oh my God, the physical body is a device that responds to the environment with all these receptors, eyes, ears, nose, taste, touch, pain, pressure, temperature, all these sensory receptors of emotion. And I say, yeah, but that's the lander.
Yeah.
It's responding to the world. And I say, yeah, but how do I know that experience? The answer is because my nervous system converts my life experiences into an electromagnetic broadcast, a vibrational broadcast that's sent back to source. So when I realized this, the first 1 minute was, oh, my God, I'm spiritual. Second 1 minute, I'm immortal. Why? Because if the body dies, the broadcast is still going.
Yeah.
And then thirdly, and this is the one that just blew my mind, and that is, oh, my God, I come to Earth, get into this virtual reality suit called a body. I manipulate this suit, create a life, and get life experiences back. I know what pain feels like. I know what love feels like. I know what being happy is like. I get all these sensations from where? My body is breaking the environment down into the chemistry, which then the nervous system is translating into the vibration. And all of a sudden I go, third minute, first minute, you know, I'm this immortal thing, you know?
Yeah.
And then by about 3 minutes later, I realize, oh, my God, people think if you die, you go to heaven. And all of a sudden I realize this possibility. What if you're born into heaven? What if this is heaven? For what reason? Because this is where we come to create. This is where we come to experience. When we're dead, we're left with the memory of the experience, but you can't eat another chocolate bar.
Yes.
you can't see a different sunset. You've already done that, okay? You have to come back again. And all of a sudden I realized, oh, my God, everybody's thinking, after I leave here, I'm going to go to heaven. And I think this big joke, you know, is like after you leave here and you go back up to the energy of spirit, and then you say, well, I want to go to heaven. And they say, no, you were just there.
Interesting.
And then you say, but then the logical question is, well, if this is heaven, then why the hell are we creating this mess? And then the answer is simple. Because we are no longer creating from our personal spiritual wishes and desires, we're creating from our programming. And if we buy a program of Darwin that says life is a struggle, competition, fight, and all that, and we buy that program, then we live with that program.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bottom line joke of the whole thing is the movie The Matrix, built as science fiction, is more actually a documentary.
Wow. I'm going to have to watch the trilogy again and look at it that way.
Just the first one. All you need to
Just the first one.
Simply this, is that you have to take the pill to wake up from the program. We've been programmed by misperceptions, things that are not accurate. The Darwinian theory is not accurate, yet we built a life based on competition. The belief that genes control our lives, we built a whole healthcare system as we're victims of genes.
Yeah.
When it turns out, no, we're not. We master the genes. We built a life on a Newtonian vision of a mechanical universe based on materialism, a belief that matter is primary. So what do we as people do on this planet? seek all the matter we can get. We own so much damn matter that we actually have to rent storage places outside of the house to put all the extra matter.
And then we have a TV show to get rid of it all when we decide we're not going to keep track of it, and then somebody else gets it.
Exactly. And we what do? We undermine the entire planet to what? Accumulate the matter, when the joke was quantum physics says the material world isn't primary, it's the energy world that's primary. Quantum physics is a bigger science than Newtonian physics. Newtonian physics fits inside of quantum physics.
Yeah.
And why is that relevant? Because, well, we keep seeking matter to prove our worth in the hierarchy of life. Matter was irrelevant. Why did you get the matter? Well, if I get this money, then I'm going to buy that car. And I can say, yeah, but why are you going to buy that car? Because that car is going to make me happy.
Mm.
Then all of a sudden I thought, you know, you could be happy without a car.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden you realize if your goal was happy, you didn't need to put the car in there. You could be happy without the car. And all of a sudden, we start to realize it wasn't the material things that we really came for. It was the non-material things.
Yes.
Love,
yes.
Beauty, joy, happiness. That's a quantum reality. So we change the beliefs from the old beliefs, we change the direction of a civilization with an intention and purpose to create harmony, a garden, love, joy, peace. That is the destination we want. And yet we bought into programs of limitation that says, who do you think you are? You don't deserve things. You're not lovable. And once we buy that, if you buy that, I love it. It just comes down to what Henry Ford said. If you think you can or you think you can't, you're right.
It's right. I have to tell you that for the first 38 years of my existence here, I did not own a car. And I got around just fine. Thank you very much. And I had a good time. I had a great time.
We're going to learn that coming up. A lot of people are going to learn that because the there's going to be a dumping of material. Why? Because there's no economy that will support that.
It will support it, exactly. Before we wrap up the program, I have two final questions that I want to ask you. Number one, who is Bruce Lipton?
He's a happy boy. I'm going to tell you that right now. He started out like thinking, why did I end up in this world? You know, I mean, it was like, oh my God, dysfunctional upbringing, all kinds of things like that, and go, oh my God, learning the secret that my thoughts create my life, and that my thoughts have been programmed, and that I could reprogram those to the way I wanted them. I now find myself absolutely in the total belief and life of I live in heaven. And my new book, which is really exciting, is called The Honeymoon Effect, The Science of Creating Heaven on Earth. And what's so interesting about it, we always talk about, well, we create our lives, and everybody goes, I wouldn't create this crap, you know? And it's like, oh, wait. I go back to a time you fell head over heels in love, and I ask three questions. I go, when you were in that deep love, you just got blown out by love. I say, were you healthy? And almost everybody goes, exuberantly healthy. I say, did you have energy? And they laugh because they know they made love for days without stopping for food or sleep. And then I go, was life so beautiful in that period called the honeymoon that you couldn't wait for the next day to have more? And they all go, yeah. I go, well, that was sort of like creating heaven on earth, wasn't it? They go, yeah. And I go, that wasn't an accident. That wasn't a coincidence. You actually did that creation. No matter how bad the world was up to the moment you met this person, when you met this person, all of a sudden it was heaven on earth. It may have only lasted a week, a month, if you're lucky, a longer, called the honeymoon. And my point is, A, that was not an accident. It was a creation. And B, if you know how you created it, then all of a sudden it says, but why can't you have that experience for the rest of your life? And the answer is you can. So I tell you how you created it, and the answer is simple. It is the one time in your life you operate from your creative conscious mind, which is the seat of your spirit, your identity. Most of the rest of our lives, 95% of our life comes from the subconscious programmings, especially the programs that were downloaded into us before we were 7 years of age.
Mm-hmm.
So the point was what? When did you create heaven on earth? When you dropped the programs that we operate from in our subconscious mind and live from the wishes and desires and aspirations of the conscious mind, you created heaven on earth. The honeymoon ends when life gets so busy that your conscious mind starts thinking again. And when it's thinking, by definition, it's not paying attention. And when it's not paying attention, we automatically default into the subconscious programs. And as the book describes, the fundamental subconscious programs we downloaded from other people. So when we're conscious, we're operating from our wishes and desires. And when our conscious mind is busy thinking, we default to the taped programs, the habits in the subconscious mind, which are predominantly other people's beliefs that we downloaded. Mm-hmm. And then you realize, when I operated from my wishes, I created heaven on earth. When I went back to the program, it turned back to hell on earth. And
yeah.
It's like, the choice was take the red pill, get out of the program, and create heaven on earth again.
Exactly. Final question before we go, and I want to thank you so much for taking this time to share with us. This has been fascinating. What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing?
I would like people to wake up to their creative power of who they really are. That if, imagine if each one of us let go of the programs that have limited us, and we all of a sudden started living the honeymoon. If everybody on the planet started to live in the honeymoon experience, which is what? Operating from your conscious mind, wishes, mm-hmm. and desires, then by definition, Earth would be heaven. I mean, that's what you seek when you, that's what you experience. So rather than limiting to a few and an occasional experience, it became a way of life. This planet, you'd wake up every day and go, oh my God, I am so lucky to be alive on planet Earth. And when everybody's saying that, it'll be real.
You know, that brings to mind a passage, a biblical passage, as well as some theoretical, I guess it's physics, where it says that everything began first as a thought. And the biblical passage is, the kingdom of heaven is within you. Ergo, if you think that you are living in the kingdom of heaven, then it will then manifest.
That's biologically sound, Richard. That's exactly what the epigenetics is.
Oh, well, wonderful.
I'm
on the right path.
I've been working on it, and I've been loving it.
Well, we have been loving having you on the program, and I hope we can have you back again soon to talk more about this, because, as always, there are always more questions than there is time on the program.
Richard, I so appreciate you giving me this opportunity. I appreciate everyone listening, of course, because every one of us has the opportunity to create this heaven on earth, and I look forward to that because the other view we're entertaining right now is not that exciting.
Bruce Lipton's my guest, and give us the title of the new book, and when is that going to be out?
May 1st, and it's called The Honeymoon Effect, The Science of Creating Heaven on Earth. And I love it because I don't have to say, imagine doing this. Almost everybody at some point in their life actually did it, and all I ask you to do is go back to that time and realize how beautiful it was when you did it.
All right. The Honeymoon Effect, Spontaneous Evolution, The Biology of Belief. Bruce Lipton, my guest. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan. Join us every Saturday from 3 to 4 p.m. Pacific Time. Until next Saturday, love to Lal.